Thank you for listening to this podcast from TVO Today, in partnership with the Toronto Star and the Investigative Journalism Bureau. If you believe in this immersive reporting, please visit tvo.org to donate to TVO and thestar.com to subscribe to the Toronto Star. We recorded the following episode in front of a live audience at the Hot Docs Ted Rogers Cinema in Toronto, Canada. We're going behind the scenes for a special conversation with the key people involved in making The Ultimate Choice.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Lori Few. I am the exec producer of digital at TVO. Yeah. And thank you very, very much for coming tonight. As I said earlier, this is a bit of an intimate crowd, which is exactly what we wanted. So I want to start this evening by doing a quick introduction to why we're here. And why we're here is because of this extremely important podcast, but I'm going to step back a bit. I work at a place called TVO, and I love working at that place because TVO inspires learning that changes lives and enriches communities. And this is one of those communities. And the goal of our podcasts, in light of that, is to bring information to our listeners that helps them better understand the province and the world that they live in. And this podcast is one of those things. As you can see, it's more than a podcast done by TVO. We have partners, the Investigative Journalism Bureau, which we'll hear more about, the Toronto Star, and Pitts Gloria Productions. And you'll meet all these people and these things, so we'll explain more about that. But I want to talk a little bit about the podcast itself. This is a difficult topic, but it's also an extremely important topic. And when we decided to take on this topic, we knew we were going to be grappling really, really challenging issues that, quite frankly, are sometimes hard to talk about and hard to hear. So this podcast is taking you on that journey through the story of one man, Michael Fraser, and his wife, and his pastor, and his doctor, and then on to other people like Michael Fraser. So that's going to be part of what we're talking about tonight. Before we get to that, I should say that you will meet Anne, and you'll meet Nav, I'm going to call him right now, and the team that did the podcast. I think we have the pastor here in the audience as well. There he is. But before we get to those people, I want to start the evening with a bit of music. And this music you're about to hear is originally composed, and it's composed for this podcast because it was as important to us that the music supports this story and the people in this story in an equally important and careful way as the characters themselves. So on that note, I'd like to bring the composer to the stage. I'd like you all to meet Allison Leighton Brown, who did this work.
Thank you so much, Lori. It is my honor to be here. I hope you can all appreciate how truly unique it is that music be included in an event like this. As a composer, this is a rare experience and something that really speaks to the depth of the storytelling, to a recognition that stories are told in so many different ways, and a story this personal really deserves to be told in as many dimensions as possible. Music can express what words cannot. Music is a bridge between people, between the human realm and the spiritual realm. And that is how I entered the world of this story and of Michael and Anne's story, of all the stories that come together in a space that is neither here nor there. And I am thrilled to be able to welcome Lucia Tico from the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, who is going to, yes, who is going to perform several excerpts of the score. We'll hear music now at a point in the middle and then to close the evening. So truly thank you for including us, not just in this evening, but in the process in such a meaningful way, and for entrusting me to help tell your stories. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. We're casual here tonight. So what I'm going to do is introduce the panelists now. And I think I'm going to start with Rob. Why not? I'd like to start with Rob. So Rob Cribb is an investigative journalist with the Toronto Star. I'm not going to say award-winning. We all know that. But he is also the guy who runs the Investigative Journalism Bureau. They are a cutting-edge newsroom that looks at issues of mental health, but they're a lot more than that. And I'm going to just ad lib here. Just happen to know they're a newsroom that brings us the next generation of some of the most amazing journalists in Canada. So I'm going to point some of them out. Massey over here. There he is. Where's Wendy Ann? There she is back there. They work all the time. Look at that. They're truly amazing. It's an amazing program that is allowing journalism to foster in this country. So thank you, Mr. Cribb. I think next I'll bring up Suzanne Reber, if you don't mind. Suzanne Reber is, yes, an award-winning investigative journalist. She's one of ours. She comes from Canada, but the Americans stole her away a long time ago to go down to do all kinds of things in the States. Most notably, she started the first investigative radio program and podcast called Reveal. Check it out on your podcast, wherever you hear your podcasts. Amazing work. And she saw and heard about the story about Michael Fraser when it first came out in print at the Toronto Star. And, well, as they say, the rest is history. She had a vision for how this could be a podcast. And here it is. It's a podcast. I would like next to bring up Dr. Nav Prasad. Thank you. Dr. Nav Prasad is the family doctor, and I think I'm going to go so far to say his friend of Michael Fraser. It's an incredible story, Dr. Prasad, of kindness and medical care and a really incredible journey. So this is the kind of doctor you dream of, who knows all the medical things and also understands the personal journey you're going on. And now I would like to invite to the stage Anne Fraser. Anne Fraser is Michael's wife. Anne Fraser also is one of the bravest women I've ever met, because she agreed to go on this journey because she knew Michael would want this. And I think it's so powerful to hear this story through your words, Anne, and bring it to this audience and audiences everywhere.
Thank you all for being here. We're really grateful that you came. I'm not sure why you came, but we're grateful that you did. This is a very special moment for me and for all of us. Certainly, it's been a remarkable journey, at times revelatory, painful, tender, and at all times, I would say, for me anyway, inspiring. And I just want to, maybe can I just say a round of applause for these three people, because it's what they've done is extraordinary. I've been a passenger on this train, and it's changed me. I think I'm changed by it and by you guys. So I'm grateful to just be in the same room and to be able to talk about this. It's hard to talk about this. We don't tend to talk about death in our society. Most of us don't want to. I'm one of them. I never wanted to. But for the last year, I would say my team and the people up here have been thinking about it and talking about it on an almost daily basis, and it's been a remarkable privilege. The greatest of those privileges for me was meeting Michael and Anne, for sure. If you've listened, you know that they are the heartbeats of this story and this narrative, and through it, through their experience, we were able to tell a much broader story about a systemic, fundamental change in our country, in our society, and the implications of all of that. Without them, none of this, of course, happens. So, Anne, thank you for the privilege of knowing you and becoming friends with you. Michael couldn't be with us tonight, obviously. Or maybe he is, we don't know. Tell us, let's start here. What was this like for you to not only live through the unimaginable wrenching process of watching your husband die and be asked to assist him in this? That's more than what most of us might be able to handle. But then to make that second choice, to say, yes, I would like to take part in a public telling of that story, with material that is the most sensitive and personal imaginable. Why did you do that?
Michael needed to tell his story. That was his beginning request after we had our conversation about me helping him end his life. That was not going to happen. I couldn't do that. That would have killed me too. So in our discussions, Michael wanted his story told, and there was nobody who was going to be able to tell it. And we were very lucky that Nav put us together with Rob, who made that happen. And throughout the whole process, Michael would say to me, you know, I'm really scared to let people know this story. I want them to know it, but I'm really scared to tell them. And at one point when we had started, when you were interviewing him, he said to me, I'm not sure I can do this. And I said, honey, of course you can do this. You want people to understand what's going on, why you're doing this, and to help those who need to make that decision themselves to start to make that process happen, and for others who are supporting them to understand that they're very important in this. The second half of your question, why would I not support this story going public and going out into the whole world. There's so many people who need to hear this, that we need to change this conversation about death, dying in all of its capacities and varieties. This is not the only way to go, but this is an important way to go. And we need to be open and honest about that conversation. We need to support one another in order to make that happen.
Take us to the moment when this was a long, protracted process, much longer than I imagined it would be. I've never done a podcast. I didn't know what a podcast was before this thing. I'm a print guy, and I was lured into this world by my friend Suzanne Reber. It takes a long time. We sat down for lengthy conversations. Then there'd be long delays where there was editing and things like that. So you told this story. I mean, you and I have gone through this many times. We've talked about this a lot. And then it went silent for a very long time. Take me to the moment, the day of launch, you sat down, you hit play. And this is a year after, right? This is a year after Michael's death. So there's been time and space. What was it? Tell us what that was like. Take us into your living room.
I took the day off. I could not even fathom the idea of being around. I work in childcare. So I work with toddlers and preschoolers right now. And the day of the launch, I went to my boss and said, I cannot be here. I need to be home. I need to listen to this in my space. I need to hear it. I need time to figure out what that's going to mean. And she was totally confused because she's kind of new to this part of the subject. She didn't know a lot about what's happened, but she was totally in agreement. If you need to take that day, take it. So I got up late and I did all the usual things. I ignored breakfast. I went for a walk. I'm like, okay, now it's time to put on the podcast. I'm like, I don't know. I'm so excited. I'm like, I am so scared. How is this going to sound? He's been gone for a while now, and this has taken a long time to happen. There were a lot of, in between and breaks where nothing was happening. So I turned it on. I put it on the computer, and I sat there with a really big cup of tea, and I let it rip. And I love the music. It's incredible. Oh, my goodness. It so enriches the story. It does. And then I heard my own voice. I'm like, oh, my God, do I sound like that? Really? Yes, I now know I do. Even daily, I can hear it now. It's a little bit weird. So we got through the music, and I say we because it was me, myself, and I, all three of us. And then Michael starts talking, and that did it for me. I fell apart. I cried through the rest of the whole podcast. And then a couple hours later, I went back and put it on again so I could actually hear it this time and not cry over it. And I kept thinking, he really does sound like Yoda. I miss him. He does. At that point, he really sounded like Yoda. And we both like Star Wars, so it made perfect sense. But the ability to hear his story being told from his words, his viewpoint, and to be able to have supported him through that, it was the hardest decision he ever made, but it was also the most difficult decision I ever made. And there was no way I wasn't going to support him through this. There just wasn't. He needed this, and I understood that. And that's why we loved each other. I was just even like the tip of the iceberg.
You said no at first. You said you can't. What changed your mind? Tell us about that process where you went from no to yes.
It was watching him get sicker. By the time he came to me to ask me that question, I already knew it was coming. He was starting to turn colors. He was starting to turn yellow. That's not a good sign. He was having way more seizures. Those things were nightmares. It was. The one day I came home and he had a fall. Actually, he'd had three falls. I didn't know how much they had increased. And I came home and found him on the floor in a pool of blood with a couple of gashes, one right across the side of his head. And it was pretty deep. And then another one over here I didn't notice because I was too busy trying to make sure that the blood had stopped. And here I am calling 911 and going, yeah, he's on the floor. He's bleeding. It's not good. And he and I, we were conversing about this already. Honey, I don't want to see what's coming. I don't want to go through this. We already had three support workers a day coming. That was the only way I could go to work in the morning and know he'd still be in one piece when I, relatively one piece when I got home. But when we got to that morning and I was getting dressed and I knew he was standing there, he was going to say something and I was like, this is not going to be good. What am I going to do? I'm going to listen. That's what I did. I listened. Honey, we're going to have this talk. Oh, crap. Last time we had one of these, you proposed to me. I was very confused. I thought you were ending it. This time it was an ending, but it was also a beginning. Honey, I can't do this anymore. You have to help me end my life. Not a chance in hell. But I agree. You need help. And I'm not the person to do this for you. I can support you any other way to 6 days to Sunday. But someone else needs to help us with this. And it's not our battle to do alone. There is a program. It will help.
Which is a perfect segue to Dr. Prasad. None of us are here tonight without that phone call. You know, there's these phone calls that happen in your life, like you get, there's three magical phone calls you get in your life. And so one of those three magical phone calls for me was the one from Nav Prasad, who introduced me to Michael. And it was the beginning of all of this. And I thank you again. I've thanked you many times, but I thank you for calling me. You are an enigmatic voice in this podcast and generally on this issue. You're fascinating, I think, because there is such polarization in the medical community, particularly psychiatric community, on this issue. And yet you're a voice of nuance that's really quite unique. You have a uncomfortable relationship with this issue. You're a doctor who never dreamed that he would be helping his patients die. I feel that you're uncomfortable with it, and yet you've done it a handful of times at the request of patients to respect their wishes. When you think about Michael's story in particular and where you stand in this debate, what for you is the moral of all of this? What is the moral of Michael's story, and where do you fit in the spectrum of discussion on this issue?
Listening to the podcast, I think what strikes me most is Michael and Anne's foresight in wanting to tell this story, to share this story with others. I think the complicated issues and the contention comes into focus when we think about a particular individual's story. And I think that's a really important contribution from the podcast and the other coverage of Michael and Anne's story. I had some trouble with it initially when Michael first requested that I help him share his story. Doctor-patient confidentiality is vitally important to what we do. And so I had trouble seeing the vision. But now I can better understand, now hearing the podcast, I can better understand what Michael and Anne had in mind when they wanted to share his story. So maybe even though he's not here tonight, he saw this before we did. Maybe he was the first, in a sense, to hear the podcast and to want to share his story in the variety of ways that it has been shared now. So thinking about Michael's story in general and how it connects to these general issues around MAID and the important swirling questions, I think it's important to answer the question that you pose in the podcast: what do you do when a particular individual has decided that they want help ending their life?
I asked you this, I know, in the podcast, but you were his doctor for 10 years. Like, this wasn't a drive-by. You knew him and you cared about him. And every instinct in me, I knew him a much shorter time, but every instinct in me, because I came to know him and feel very deeply about him. And my instinct was, I don't want you to do this. I want you to not do this. But you never tried to convince him otherwise. Why?
I definitely had reservations. And even though I was in listening mode the first time Michael broached the topic of MAID, definitely in the back of my mind, I was going through all of the other things we could do, other tests we could run, other referrals I could make, other doctors he might visit. And part of me was hoping he might change his mind. But ultimately, I had to consider that likely there was a process leading up to him mentioning it explicitly the first time. And in retrospect, I could see that he had actually made some comments before, even some jokes about dying, that likely were his way of testing out the waters. And so even though it wasn't something I was pleased to hear, I understood fairly quickly the direction things were heading in. And I also understood my relatively unimportant role in supporting a decision that one of my patients had made.
I know you've listened to the podcast. Is there anything that you've heard? It goes beyond Michael's story, obviously, but is there anything that you heard that you found that you didn't know or that you learned or that you found curious or interesting? I'm just interested in your reaction to it.
A few things. First of all, I maybe like Anne, I was struck first by the music. I also had some trepidation about listening to the podcast, about there being a podcast. When I first switched it on, what I heard first was the music, and immediately accepted how real this was and how big Michael's story was. And I think that's really well captured by the score. I learned a lot from listening to Anne and Michael, whose voices I think are the most important, in the ultimate choice in terms of exploring the struggle that an individual goes through, that an individual spouse is going through in the lead up to MAID. And if anything, the ultimate choice mostly underscores the importance of listening to people, listening to families.
I was invited by Michael to his death, his procedure, which was a life-altering moment for me. And of course, you performed it, and there's this remarkable moment that I'll never forget. We're leaving together after this momentous event. And we walked down the staircase and out into the bright sunshine. It was a beautiful summer day. And I was clearly in shock. I don't know about you. I was clearly in shock. And there was this moment, like, what? I was just thinking, what do we just get in our cars now and go home? And is this what happens? Like, what do you do? Looking back on all this now with the benefit of time and space, would you do anything different?
I think about it all the time. I think about the entire 10 years I had the privilege of caring for Michael, whether there are things I could have done differently, services that could have been offered. Certainly as these larger questions are asked about MAID, especially for people who are experiencing disadvantages, whether or not poverty is pushing people to seek MAID or a lack of healthcare supports are pushing people towards MAID. And some of that actually came up, I think, in response to sharing Michael's story. Certainly, I ask myself all the time about whether there were things I could have done 5 years ago, 10 years ago differently. There's also no textbook on how to conduct conversations about MAID and in the lead up to MAID. So I do wonder if maybe I should have asked Michael about MAID earlier than him asking me for MAID, because he had given indications that he had had enough. So there are a million things that I wonder whether I should have done them differently.
When we first had our initial meetings with Allison about the music, one of the first questions she and Suzanne asked the group of us is, let's think about what instruments we think, what sounds, what instruments would fit the tone of this podcast. And literally, we were on an email chain, and everybody responded like the top instrument was cello. We're going to bring in Suzanne Reber now to talk about how this was all done. This is a challenging, again, I know nothing about podcasts, but here's what I do know. This is not your typical subject matter for a podcast. It's not true crime. It's not white hats and black hats. It is gray. It is deep gray. It's textured. It's nuanced. And that makes it harder to tell. There's no question about it. There's no good guys and bad guys in this thing. It's a lot of sort of tortured, contemplative, thoughtful, and difficult discussion. And that takes remarkable skill, figuring out how to tell a story like that in this format. So you had a big challenge. Why did you even agree to do this?
First of all, you're the one who asked me. We've known each other for a long time, and we've been investigative types. And I guess we're both attracted to the stories that are the ones, the difficult ones to tell. And generally, it's about some malfeasance or holding people to account. But this is actually the most existential question of all. And so I think, much like you, I was drawn to that. I didn't have the advantage until I heard your voice, Anne, of knowing any of the folks who were in the show, at least at the point where we decided to dive in. But it's a challenge, but I felt it's one of those conversations that we shy away from. We don't want to talk about these things. And I love the idea of going right there. And my job coming into this was to really think about all of you. My job is to think about the audience, to think about who's going to be listening, what kind of journey are they on? Because Anne and Nav are helping many, many people who are going to hear this show have a conversation with their partner or their family. Who knows where it's going to go? So I just felt like it was kind of time to just go for it. And I think we had a lot of trust as well, just the two of us. And I knew that you had these relationships and they were powerful. And so, yeah, I said, sure, let's do it.
We had recorded Michael. Obviously, you never met Michael, but we'd recorded him when we were doing our, so I would meet with Michael. So it was like Tuesdays with, what's that book? Tuesdays with Maury. Yeah, yeah. So I'd visit Michael in the afternoons. You were mostly not there. You were working. So in the last weeks of his life, I just keep going and hanging out. And we recorded some of those sessions. I wish we'd recorded more, but recorded some.
Me too.
Yeah, I know. I know. When you first heard his voice, what was your reaction?
First of all, I just was blessed with how funny Michael is.
Incredible, right? Hilarious.
And I think that was a gift. So again, looking at a topic like this and a subject like this, every little bit counts, because my goal was to make this about life. Even though we are talking about death, this story is really about how do you live a life? At what point do you say, I don't want to live that life anymore? And those are questions that require kind of, it's not just about endings, it's also about how did this start? This is a love story. Anne and Michael were funny together. And so I felt that Michael's voice, even though at the point where you're recording him, he literally couldn't speak that well anymore. And so, you know, it's hard to hear him sometimes. Even in our trailer, his voice is breaking. And you could say, well, why did we include that? Well, that's the real Michael at that point. We try and help the audience. Occasionally, we actually wrote, you know, I wrote lines that Rob could explain to the listener. Sometimes I could barely hear his voice, even though I was sitting right next to him. I mean, we try and give you assistance in listening, but it is the real Michael. And it's not, you know, this is not high fidelity sound when somebody is ill. So I think it's important to come at this from the perspective of the audience. What's the audience going to feel? And I don't want them to feel sad all the time, even though there are moments where we feel sad. I want them to feel the joy of that relationship, the love that existed for many, many years and still exists today, of course. So that's what I heard in those voices. And I tried as best I could to reflect those highs and lows throughout the show. And the gift of the music you've all heard, and you heard it without any words being spoken over the top, is to reflect the full extent of life, and to allow us to have moments where we're reflecting, moments where we're kind of maybe laughing alongside the two of you. So yeah, it was he was a gift because he decided to tell his story, but also he wasn't inhibited in how he spoke to you. And for that, I'm grateful.
Can I ask you, we've never talked about this, but having listened to hundreds of hours of this tape and gone through this process, this isn't a subject matter that you had covered before or that you particularly thought about. What have you, just can I ask you this personally, what have you learned about this subject matter and what are your reflections on all of this material? Not from a production point of view, but just this issue. Where do you sort of sit having listened to all of it?
You know, just how rich everything is. It's not really a kind of straightforward question. Yes, at the end of the day, it's like, do you have the right to make that choice? And in Canada, you do. So I was just really fascinated with the idea that in our generation, this right is more or less part of our vernacular. And perhaps that just fascinated me.
Yeah. The variations, even within Western countries, the
right.
Vast range of legislative responses to the exact same question. It's unsettled. The nature of
it's
this is
so... It's not settled at all,
yeah,
right? So I feel like it's something that this show, even though it's, you know, focused on Canada, is a very global question. And it's something that I just felt, you know, a privilege that I could dive into it.
You have a clip?
I do. I wanted to play something for you that I just, again, there are these moments in creating something like this where you just feel like this is wonderful. And earlier I spoke about the relationship, reflecting the joy as well as some of the sadness. And when I heard the story that Michael and Anne told about his love of cooking, so this is the clip I want you to hear. I just, it had to be in the show.
Well, the problem is that poor Anne, when I'm cooking, I like to sing. And
Blue Rodeo was one of his favorite bands to sing to.
Because, like, when we got married, she didn't like to cook, so she sent me to George Brown for...
I was okay to cook. He doesn't eat food. He has a terrible relationship with food. And when we got together, he was living on frozen dinners. They met in a hurricane. Turkey dinner every night. 3 minutes in the microwave.
Yeah.
That was his food for the next 3 days.
Now she...
But I insisted on cooking. He said, no, you can't cook. You have to work.
Yeah. So I went to...
So I sent him to cooking school.
I went to George Brown for a year?
Two
years. To learn how to cook properly. And I enjoy it. I mean, I can't sing. But I like to cook. But I couldn't carry a tune in a backpack, duct tape to my head.
And as you're coming up the stairs, all you can hear is 5 days in May. For those 5 days
in May. So you hear this wailing coming from the apartment.
Yep.
But hey, it's.
But the happy look on his face is incredible. It was the best thing I ever did sending you to cooking school.
Yeah.
I'd like to learn to cook. Good idea. Go to school. Find the place you've seen a
thousand times. And the reason you love that clip is because it's a moment of joy. It's a personal moment of joy.
It's a moment of joy, and also it helps to explain, without me having to again say every word, how it was that Michael started to feel like actually things aren't worth living anymore.
Because he couldn't cook anymore. Yeah.
I think he said he had cooked every meal for you after he learned to cook. For him, this was a pain. He mentioned it to you. That, I think, helps people understand what is it about life that we enjoy. And it is those things. It's the simple things, like I like to cook for Anne. And then at that point, he couldn't cook anymore. He couldn't stand up for long enough to. So for me, it wasn't just about that moment of pure joy and the story of the love affair. It was also helping to explain more than that. So I feel it's one of those moments in the show that always brings a smile to my face. There's one other aspect of letting the audience come to the story, which was actually the idea of how it is that you were so fascinated by it. You didn't even half know what brought it to you. And I think the story of your parents and your dad and the request that he had made to your mom, again, I had the privilege of you letting me in on that story, and I'm very grateful to you for letting us include it in the show. Because I think that's another way that the audience can come into this story and understand that there's something deeper for you. As you're probing this question, there are real things at stake for you as well. And I think that makes it an important journey, not just into the past. Obviously, we didn't get to meet Michael, but also into the future of what's in it for me. What am I thinking as I learn all these things?
I mean, I just want to say that this was trickery, getting me to do that.
We have 5 minutes for a Q&A, so
sure.
If you want to ask your question, and then I'll repeat it to Rob so that he can hear it.
Oh, one of the things I noticed Anne and the doctor said is the idea of listening to something that might be difficult. And in both your cases, you talked about listening because you're already listening to yourselves. sensing that this story might be coming along. And it strikes me when we're dealing with difficult things, it's so important to listen. But the other difficult thing, which you both talked of, is how do you respond even though you try to be present to that moment? And that whole existential question, what it means the end of my relationship is coming, even though it might be an inevitable down another route. I just really found that very, very striking. Any thoughts about how to be present to listen, but then also how am I going to respond and be supportive? How am I going to be ethical? How do I deal with differences? Thank you.
I'm already wired that way. My career has taught me that I have to be observant and that I need to listen. My little ones cannot tell me what's going on. So it's either one of four things. And I go through the checklist, but my brain is still going, I hear you are sad. I hear you are angry. In Michael's case, is your life isn't living anymore. You've lost the skill to walk down the stairs. That almost killed me when I said to him, I can't get you down the stairs. I cannot myself get you up off the floor anymore. That's life. You can't walk out the door. If you suddenly couldn't walk out the door, what would you do?
Are we at time? Okay. I want to personally, obviously, thank these three up here. Please join me in thanking them. I'd like to thank TVO for allowing us to do this podcast. I'd like to thank the Investigative Journalism Bureau team, two of whom are here, Massey Calatbari, Wendy Ann Clark, the Toronto Star, of course, and I'm deeply indebted to you guys. Thank you so much. This has been a remarkable journey, and I hope it'll continue.